Please ensure all cell phones are turned off or placed on silent. If there are any members of council who have to disclose a pecuniary interest, seeing none, the next item on the agenda is the consent agenda. I will read out the title associated with the items on the agenda. Members of the Planning and Development Committee may ask that the item be held so that it can be further discussed. Please indicate your intention to hold an item by pressing your request to speak button. The first person on the list will be given the opportunity to speak first to the item. If an item is not held, the motion will be deemed approved on consent, and no further discussion on the item will take place tonight at this meeting. The recommendation will go forward to Council for their consideration at the next meeting. So the recommendations from the from advisory committees, Heritage Caledon report dated April 10th, 2017, approved on consent. Recommendation from Heritage Caledon regarding the name recommendation for Palgrave Parkette, held by Jennifer, Councillor Innes. Confidential staff report 2017-7 regarding advice that is subject to solicitor client privilege and litigation, including members before an administrative tribunal affecting the municipality, Mayfield West Phase 2 OMB appeals. Councillor Mezzapelli asked for it to be held. Okay, we will move now into the public meeting portion of this evening's agenda. The public meeting is regarding the proposed rezoning amendment, bylaw amendment of 12700 Regional Road 50, West Side Regional Road 50, north of McEwen Drive East, Part Lot 4, Concession 6, Albion, Parts 1, 2, 3, 4, 9, and 10 on 43R-34893 Ward 5. The purpose of this public meeting is to gather input from the public concerning the application. Any members of the public who have written concerns or appeals dealing with the application being heard should be directed to the clerk's office. Any interested persons wishing further notification regarding any of the applications are advised to clearly print their name and address on the notification list located on the table at the entrance to the council chambers. Following each presentation, members of the public will be invited to approach the podium, clearly stating their name and address for the public record and providing their comments. If you have presentation material, please provide the copy to the recording secretary at the desk to your left. And please note that any information submitted this evening will form part of the town's record. The following public comments, members of council will be invited to ask questions of the presenter regarding the information contained within the presentation. Please note that council members are here to listen to the comments from the public and are not here to provide an opinion or debate the matter. We will now move to the public meeting that's listed in the agenda. Now I will ask Christina DiBonetto, the town's community planner of development, to confirm that the notification was conducted in accordance with the Planning Act for the public meeting concerning this matter.
Through you, Chair DeBoer. Notice was provided by mail to landowners within 120 meters of the subject lands. Notice was placed in the Caledon Citizen and the Enterprise and posted on the town's website.
Thank you, Ms. DiBonetto. I will now call upon Mark Daenerys from Gagnon Walker Domes to begin his presentation. Mark.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of committee, town staff, members of the public. My name is Mark Dunardis from Gagnon Walker Domes Limited Urban Planners. I act as planning consultant to API Development Consultants, Inc., a numbered company 1544216 Ontario, Inc., for the property municipally known as 12700 Regional Road 50, part of Lot 4, Concession 6. Purpose of this meeting, in accordance with the Ontario Planning Act, to present the proposal to the public and to receive any comments or questions of the public and members of council they may have. A planning report will be considered by council, will be prepared at a later date. For anyone wishing to be notified of the council date, please provide your contact information on the sign-in sheets provided in the lobby and will be part of the public record. By signing in, you agree that the information is now part of the public record for this application. No recommendation or decision on the proposal will be made this evening. The subject site has a total site area of 1.03 hectares or 2.55 acres. It has a lot depth of 178.12 meters or 584.38 feet. It has road frontages of along Regional Road number 50 and McEwen Drive West. To the north is a large-scale multi-tenant commercial development. To the south, Dominion Bank. To the east, Regional Road 50, large-scale commercial complex beyond. To the west, a multi-tenant industrial office complex. On October 2011, rezoning application town file RZ1111 rezoned the property to general commercial special section 515 to permit a restaurant or financial institution, convenience restaurant, and hotel. A zoning amendment application and site plan applications were filed in December 2016 by API Development, Inc. The applications were deemed complete in December 2016. The purpose of this application is to amend the zoning bylaw from general commercial exception 515 to general exception numbered unknown to permit the development of a medical center and establish site-specific zone standards. The medical center will be located on the vacant pad in front of the existing hotel, which you can somewhat see in this photo. Directly looking in front of the hotel. A series of plans and reports were filed in support of the applications. They are as follows: an architectural site plan, elevations, a 3D rendering, landscape plans, letter of conformance, cost estimate, a functional servicing brief, site servicing and grading plans, a planning justification report, and draft zoning bylaw, and a traffic impact and parking utilization study. The image you see on this slide is a copy of the proposed site plan. The blue footprint in your top left represents the proposed medical center. Pad A, being the medical center, has a footprint of 514 square meters, but a total gross floor area of about just over 2,100 square meters. Pad B, being the existing restaurant, has a gross floor area of 172.8 square meters, and pad C, being the existing hotel, has a pad or a footprint of 1,000 square meters and a gross floor area of 6,300 square meters with a basement. Total parking spaces provided on site is 148. Vehicular access is provided from Regional Road number 50, McEwen Drive West. A 6-meter landscape open space buffer is provided along Regional Road number 50. This image here is just a copy of the proposed an elevation of the medical center. And this is a rendering if you were traveling south on Highway 50, looking southwest. And that would be the corner you would be seeing of the proposed building. Governing planning policy. Regional appeal official plan, according to Schedule D, in the regional structure, the property is designated rural service center. Rural service centers serve as the primary foci of growth. Proposal conforms with the regional official plan. According to the town of Caledon official plan, Schedule A1, in the town structure, the property is designated rural service center. Schedule C6, Bolton Community Shopping Center, commercial area. The property is located within Precinct Area G. An amendment to the official plan is not required. The proposal conforms with the town official plan. Zoning bylaw 2006-50 as amended. The property is zoned general commercial, exception 515, and the proposed zoning is general commercial, exception number to be determined. We are seeking an exception to permit a medical center and establish site-specific zone standards, including setback, building height, and a parking ratio. Existing uses that are permitted on the site include a suite of uses. I'll just briefly touch upon some of them as they're listed on this slide. An office is permitted as of right, a clinic, drive-through service facility, dry cleaning or laundry outlet, financial institution, fitness center, grocery store, hotel, laundromat, merchandise service shop, personal service shop, place of assembly, place of entertainment, private club, restaurant, retail stores, service and repair shop, a training facility, a video outlet, and rental store. So once again, the subject site is already zoned for commercial uses. We're just seeking to include a medical center as part of the suite of existing uses that are allowed. Okay. In terms of next steps, if you wish to be notified of the decision of the Town of Caledon in respect to the passing of the future zoning bylaw amendment application, you must make a written request to the Clerk's Department. Any oral submissions or written submissions will reserve your appeal rights. For further information, you can contact the town planner, Christina Di Benedetto. Her contact information is provided below. And that concludes my presentation. Any questions? I'm open to the floor.
Thank you, Mark. If you want to just sit here in case there's questions of you from anybody, that would be good. Are there any comments from the members of the public who are here this evening? Please step up to the podium, stating your name, and provide your comments through the microphone.
Yeah, my name is Bob Hidman, and I own a company, Northwest Holdings in Bolton. And the property that's to...
Can you, pardon? Oh, you did say, did you say Bob Hidman?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the property is to the south, which is where the McDonald restaurant is, and the other property is to the west. And, of course, the bank is there, too, alongside of the property. And the only thing that I notice a lot lately, and it's been an ongoing thing, that the bank doesn't have much parking. And there's a lot of people now, what they do, they go across to into our parking at McDonald's and go to the bank. Sometimes even the employees that work there leave their car there. And they also bring it into my property at on McEwen on the west there. And parked there, so I don't like to go against any anybody doing anything, which I've never did. But I'm just wondering if there's enough parking there, or will it get worse? Because right now there's a lot of problems with that going on, and some of the tenants in my place, they come to me and say, "Look, there's no parking here because there's a whole bunch of people leaving their cars and going over to the bank or whatever the case may be." So. Just if they done a traffic study, I wonder was that taken into consideration, especially with the bank, because the bank has hardly any parking there.
Mark, have you done any parking studies and traffic studies?
Yes, through you, Mr. Chair. We did file a traffic impact study and parking utilization study as part of the formal submission. It's currently under review. I know that town staff and regional staff have their comments, and we haven't made a resubmission just yet. There is a parking deficiency here. I'm not going to deny that. The parking requirement under the bylaw is about 190 spaces. We're able to provide 148, so there's a deficiency of about 42 spaces, but our parking consultant or traffic consultant assessed the peak times of the other uses on this property being the hotel and the drive-through, and they were of the opinion that there's more than sufficient parking provided on site, even with a medical center there.
Get that, Bob?
Well, yes. Is there any way that we could get the updated traffic study complete before things are passed through?
They would have to be passed and approved before thing is completed.
Well, I think that's the only problem I got, because right now there is a lot of problems already, so I'm just, I do go over to the A&W, and I've been there a few times, but the problem is the bank, I think, is the big problem. They're the ones that are kind of it never had any parking much to begin with.
Okay. I'm sure Mark, Bob will, if your name's out there, Mark will be able to supply you with that information when it does get that far.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Any other members of the public who wish to speak?
Good evening. My name is Saul Quint. I'm a family physician at the Goodfellow Medical Center on McEwen Drive. I'm here. I'm also the associate lead of the Family Health Organization, which is a group of 11 doctors across Bolton. and across Caledon. I'm also representing another 11 doctors who are part of the Family Health Organization, the associate leader of the Family Health Organization, with 11 doctors as members. I'm also representing Rebecca Bodock, who is the head of the Family Health Group, which has another 11 physicians across Caledon as part of the Family Health Group. So essentially, I'm talking on behalf of 22 physicians. We have some serious concerns about another medical building for reasons that are really purely medical. The Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care has for some time now been attempting to create centralized multidisciplinary care as the most inexpensive, most cost-effective, and best care for patients. And already in Caledon, there are probably 3 to 4 walk-in clinics, numerous individual physicians scattered across the in different plazas, across the courtyards. So basically all corners of Caledon have a lot of physician offices. There are also 3 large medical buildings. All 3 of those medical buildings have significant vacancies. We have some challenges in terms of the Family Health Organization. I'm not sure what plans the owners of this new medical building have, but the ministry has forbidden the creation of any new family health organizations or additional members to our family health organization. So essentially, a physician can only join our family health organization if somebody retires, and the creation of a new family health organization is forbidden as it stands by the ministry. I'm happy to explain the difference between a family health organization and a family health team and a family health group if it's necessary, but the bottom line is they are the preferred choices for comprehensive, multidisciplinary, centralized care. In order to have that, you need to have an X-ray, which requires a license from the ministry. No new licenses are being permitted for diagnostic imaging. So I'm not quite sure how this new medical building could even create a diagnostic imaging facility. There already is a diagnostic imaging facility which includes mammography, bone density, X-ray, ultrasound, et cetera, et cetera. Laboratory services are well supplied. In our building, for instance, there are a number of physicians who are still accepting patients and basically have no waiting list for new patients. Some of our ancillary services, like our chiropractor, has actually moved into a smaller space because he was unable to get the patient load to fulfill his larger space, and actually requested a move into a smaller area in order to essentially keep going. So again, there's some question about whether there's any demand at all for additional buildings with additional services to further sort of split the what once upon a time 10 years ago was a significant, you know, patient excess and physician shortage. One other example, a recent doctor who joined the Goodfellow Medical Center, Dr. Halim, who has no financial interest in the building whatsoever, runs a managed practice. Physicians nowadays, especially younger physicians, do not want to run their own practices. They want to be part of a managed multidisciplinary practice. She and her husband, who has been a physician recruiter in Newfoundland before now, run a managed practice. He spends over $1,000 a month on Google and on Facebook trying to recruit new physicians. Councillor Groves has met a number of physicians who've come out to look at Caledon. And essentially, at the end of the day, they say, when you've got a patient list, call me and I'll join your practice. So he has physicians in his practice that don't have full waiting lists. He has physicians who come out interested in coming to Bolton but have not enough of a patient waiting list, even though he's keeping one and advertising. And as I say, he has no vested interest in any real estate in Bolton. He's just running a managed practice and trying to grow it. So we just feel that further scattering and further creating independent things is just not in the best interest of multidisciplinary care, not in the best interest of the physicians and the ancillary people.
Okay, so. Thank you very much, Doctor. Okay. Any further members of the public?
Can I just make one other point?
Sure.
I don't know anything about this, but I just heard about the parking. Our building has 180 parking spots, I found out today. I believe this is much less than our. I don't know if anybody's come to the Goodfellow Center, but it's pretty full most of the time. There's very little spare parking, so I just wanted to point
out. Yeah, thank you. Any other members of the public who wish to speak to this application? Okay, are there any members of council who have any questions of the presenter? Councillor Shaughnessy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. Wanting to understand our stance at the town of Caledon on parking. As somebody from Ward 1, we have a serious deficiency in parking spaces for our villages. And I think when we start building things, we have to make sure that we have the right amount of spaces. Is there anything in our planning under the town of Caledon that starts to say, okay, if the spaces aren't available on the ground, that we need to start to do underground parking lot? Because I don't think it's fair. I heard one gentleman speak up that everybody goes over and parks on his space, which I find extremely unfair. Is there anything having to do with let's start thinking about how we minimize the impact to the land around us, and how do we consolidate and make parking a little more compact? And I think the idea of going underground.
You got a proposal to how you're going to fix the parking problem?
Through Mr. Chair. At this point in time, I think I would have to defer to our transportation consultant, who is not here today. We'll have to go back and run the modeling and the numbers. I think we're still going to rely on their findings that there's more than sufficient parking on site. Again, the uses that are there, they operate on peak hours. They're not operating all at the same time. You don't have, hotels operating on peak hours during Monday to Friday. They usually are the busiest on the weekends, and you would probably have the medical office, I can't say this for certainty, but maybe operating the peak times during the business days. So you'd have some excess surplus parking from the hotel allotment available for the medical center.
Okay. Councillor Shaughnessy?
Thank you. I still think that if we're going to be responsible, we have to make sure we have enough parking space. And I'm very familiar with, I'm probably in Bolton two or three times a week. And a hotel runs 24/7/11. And just because I stay in overnight doesn't mean my car isn't out in the parking lot during the day. So I do have concerns there. I think that's a valid concern of the businesses in close proximity to it. Then the other question is more from a visioning perspective. I know we're undergoing a visioning perspective of Highway 50. And I'm wondering what the impact is to, or does it comply with the visioning that we're actually doing for Bolton right now? Because I know that's underway. And I just, you know, my problem is that it seems that we always put the cart before the horse. And I know we're undergoing this visioning process, and I hate to always be saying, yeah, let's we support something, but then we finish our visioning process.
Actually, we're not here to support or not support.
I'm not saying, excuse me, Mr.
We're here to ask questions of the
delegation. Excuse me, Chair. I'm trying to explain where I'm coming from. Where I'm coming from is that we have a visioning process, and I'm worried that we're doing added planning aspects when we got something already in process. Does it fit? And I think it's Hai Ching that's actually doing it, and I don't see him here tonight. I just want to know whatever we do is going to support what we've started. If not, why are we doing it? So
I think the staff are going to have to come back because he's not here, but we have to address the application that's before us as part of the planning requirements. So yes, he can come forward at any point in time to ask for his application to be considered. We have to provide him with the opportunity to have the public meeting, and that's why we're here tonight. So
I totally understand,
staff
it, Mr.
Will
Chair. I think Peggy Tollett was going to actually try and answer it and see whether I thought she was. Tollett. Why do we say Tollett? I'm French. What can I say?
To you, Councilor DeBora, it's Tollet.
I know. It's the French in me.
I can go back to Haiching and get his comments because he is working on the visioning exercise, which is a separate exercise, but he is aware of this.
Is he aware? Okay,
yes,
I'd love to hear back, and I think others would too. Thank you very much.
Okay. Councillor Groves.
I'm only asking one question, and it's just a follow-up on the parking issue. So just for clarification, the medical center, their parking requirements is different and separate from, let's say, the hotel or the restaurant. Is it calculated at a different ratio?
Mark?
Through you, Mr. Chair. The zoning bylaw does have a site-specific, or sorry, a specific rate for medical centers. Our proposal is proposing a blended parking rate across the whole site, so our supply based on what our GFA is, and we ended up with a ratio that's going to be a blended rate, and that's supported by our parking study. But to, I guess, answer your question, the bylaw does have a site-specific medical rate, and to go back to the other counselor's question, it's important to note that the medical center isn't just a medical use. Actually, a medical center defined in the bylaw includes a suite of uses, and I'm just going to read this verbatim. It is an establishment having the main use as a clinic, which may include an optometrist with or without an accessory optician. Such medical center may include a restaurant, one pharmacy, and a medical laboratory only, but it shall not include a hospital. So a medical center includes a suite of uses, all captured into one building. So it's not just, you know, three floors of doctors. There's a series of different uses that fall all within the same umbrella of what a medical center is.
Mm-hmm. As do the other medical centers that exist currently in Bolton. They have a variety of uses there. So I think it was spoken to before as a multidisciplinary mm-hmm. building. So I just want to be clear or just have some clarification. I know when I opened my medical clinic, there were other uses that existed on the property. Mm-hmm. I couldn't use their parking and say, well, you know what, the bank only has so many people coming in at this time. I had to show that I had enough parking spaces available for the clinic only. So I'm not sure if there is any provision somewhere how you would make up for the 42 spaces that you're deficient by saying the people at the hotel, they're only there at certain times, or the restaurants. I know that I couldn't do that. So I'm not sure how that would work.
I think probably we've gone around. I think they're abundantly clear on the concern with regard to parking, and staff will have to probably come back as to what he's going to address and how they're going to address the deficiencies.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
And the region is okay with access? So right now there's a right-in, right-out. So is that going to be the same, right-in, right-out, onto
Mr.
Regional
Chair.
Road 50?
Through Mr. Chair, the proposal actually proposes a northbound left-in. Our parking consultant or traffic consultant supported that as well. I don't believe the region is satisfied just yet with that proposal for a left-in movement traveling northbound. So if we go back to the slide, I guess can't see it here. I don't believe we have any approval on that just yet, but otherwise the existing access points will remain unchanged. So.
Yeah, and I can tell you in conversations with the region on any new applications on with respect to Highway 50 frontage, part of the problem or part of the challenge that the region has and why they've imposed a right-in, right-out only on Highway 50 is because they don't want to gridlock traffic. So that would be something that I'd want to hear more from the region where they stand with that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further? Nope. Okay, I have no further questions from members of council. So this concludes the public meeting portion of this evening's agenda. Just take a few seconds.
Thank you very much. Have a good evening.
Okay. Let's take a minute or so to allow the presenter to pack up, unless he wants to stay. So we'll do consent, right? This one. Okay. Councillor Groves, are you leaving? Okay, move to the consent agenda. So we have the recommendations from Heritage Caledon regarding the naming recommendation for Palgrave Parkette, and that the parkette located in Westview Crescent in Palgrave be named the Norma Bangay Park. And we have a mover. Mayor Thompson, a seconder is Councillor Innes, and Councillor Innes asked for it to be held.
I'm going to ask that this item be deferred until an opportunity where Councillor DeBoer and myself have an opportunity to speak with staff as well as our Rotary Club, who we've been working very closely with at helping to rejuvenate and renovate this park.
Okay, so a seconder for the motion to defer, Councillor Downey. All in favor? Carried. Okay, so the next item on the agenda is the presentation. Okay, I will now call on Michael Henney, Director of Business Development. And what's that? No. The presentation. And Ms. Lana L.
Lena L.
Okay. Associate with MBTW dot Y, WAI, to approach the podium and provide a presentation concerning the townwide design guidelines. I apologize for not getting that right.
Nope, that was good. It's MBTW and WAI is our sister architectural practice. The two companies are linked, but because of the OAA, we can't really combine them as one thing. So.
Okay, thank you very much.
So we're here this evening to present this comprehensive draft of the Comprehensive Townwide Design Guidelines. We were retained in January 2016, and we've been working at this over the year with a lot of input from town staff, from regional staff, and the commenting agencies, particularly a lot of work from Paula Strachan, who has been our contact for the project. At the moment, there's the chart of our progress across the bottom. You can see that we started in March of 2016, and the first stage, which was a comprehensive review of the policy framework and of all the existing guidelines in the town. Then in stage two, we had a meeting with TAG, and we also had a consultation workshop with BUILD. Okay? Okay. And stage three, which is where we're at the bottom of tonight, is actually a public meeting to present this comprehensive draft. And the idea is that we will receive comments over the next 2 months and that the guidelines will come back to council for consideration and hopefully adoption in the fall of 2017. The guidelines are based around a set of guiding principles and also some very basic objectives, some good objectives. The first one was to have a unique Made in Caledon approach. The second was that we would provide a comprehensive townwide area-specific set of design guidelines for landscape and architectural solutions. and that we would be working to incorporate the existing guidelines, synthesize together the existing guidelines in the town. And it would be a one source. So instead of having multiple guideline sources, we would in fact be narrowing it down to one comprehensive set. We also had five basic founding principles, which had to do with, at the bottom, you'll see sustainable design and compact development, accessibility and universal design, community safety and security, complete streets and active transportation, and cultural heritage conservation. And complete streets actually is a term that has to do with making streets work and be attractive and functional for pedestrians, cyclists, and vehicles of all types, to make them safe and comfortable environments.
So the document has been prepared in four parts to make it more easy to navigate. The introduction section sets out these guiding principles and objectives at the front end of the document and can be referenced at any point for clarification throughout the design process. It also provides some clarity to the general design process with regards to how the region operates and then the town and the different hierarchy of guidance that's available in the town and how that works between policy, regulation, and guidelines. The second part is specific to the urban conditions in Caledon, so the rural service centers or the villages and even the hamlets are captured in here. And then we've established a third part over the course of developing the document, which is specific to rural Caledon, and this is a new area of guidance that we're starting to explore now. We haven't seen many precedents for this in Ontario, so it's kind of a first take at how to make sure that we can preserve the cultural heritage landscape of rural Caledon over time. And then finally, part four is specific to any area-specific guidance that's still applicable. So in Mayfield West, recent urban design guidelines, for example, have been adopted, and those are not negated because of these guidelines. Instead, they are referenced, so people are able to have a one-stop resource for all of these different areas of guidance. The document has been designed to be user-friendly and is highly graphic, with illustrations and photographs to explain the various guidelines that are presented. Each section references the guiding principles that are relevant to the section, provides a short introductory statement, and text boxes are provided throughout to provide users with references to documents, agencies, and any definitions to key terms that may be of relevance. We've also clarified the different levels of guidance in the document. So there's a hierarchy of guidance from design standards to design requirements and then encouraged practices. Design standards are mandatory, and there's not much. They're typically reflective of existing bylaw and other compliance that already exists in the town. Design requirements have some flexibility inherent in them in that they may not be appropriate in all locations. However, they're expected to be complied with, and in those special circumstances, a written justification is required to be prepared by an expert. And the process is explained in the document in detail. And then encouraged practices are also provided, which are desirable, but they're not expected of developers. So we'll go into some of the sections in more detail, not in more detail, but quickly to show you a sample of what's provided. In Urban Caledon, we speak to public open spaces and parks, edges and gateways, treatments along community streetscapes, and the general configuration and orientation of neighborhood blocks. We do speak about upgraded architectural treatments and landscape at priority lot locations, and the general connectivity and exposure to stormwater management, including low-impact development and how that might be applied. We also touch on signage, wayfinding, and public art. So some additional general guidance has been provided for green building initiatives to complement the sustainability principle of the document. And in terms of residential development, we do focus on the built form, landscape design, and even treatment of utilities. For infill development, we've provided some guidance for both alterations and infill to make sure that development can be compatible while not necessarily having to have the same architectural style in all instances. So certain architectural features that should be considered in the design of new buildings adjacent to already existing houses. We've also provided some guidance for general commercial areas, mixed-use buildings, potential new main streets, and in industrial and employment lands. And in this area, most of the guidelines in the existing industrial and commercial guidelines have been incorporated in the current in the proposed or draft document. And that's because we found that the guidelines in the industrial commercial guidelines were fairly current and applicable. And so not much of a change in there, just the consolidation. And we've provided some suggested, a lot of encouraged practices for institutional uses that could potentially assist in site planning for new school sites. In the rural Caledon section, we looked into a number of different uses, commercial and industrial uses being one, and clustering buildings and kind of grouping them so that we can preserve the cultural heritage landscape. One thing that town staff had expressed is that there's a lot of interest in specialty destinations in recent years, including wedding venues and cideries or other agritourism components. So we've provided some preliminary guidance for that. And estate housing, there are some guidelines presented here as well. So some of the highlights include active transportation. As you know, the region's very interested in active transportation, so we've tried to push urban design standards on this front. Similarly, we've done the same for low-impact development, introducing it potentially into rights-of-ways where possible, and providing a lot of encouraged practices to assist. We've addressed context-sensitive development, as I've previously mentioned, for infill communities and agritourism and on-farm diversified uses.
So, in terms of implementation, there are a number of things that still remain to be done. We have produced a background assessment paper, which in some detail looks at the process of the consolidation of existing guidelines and makes recommendations about how to deal with the existing guidelines in the town. We've also suggested that the site plan application manual be reviewed and revised by town staff to incorporate references to the appropriate references to these guidelines. The guidelines will work with the development application review team process, the DART process, and we'll also work with the urban design briefs and architectural review process as well. We are asking for shadow studies and other technical studies. Now, this is in line with what the town is already asking for. And we are also suggesting that these guidelines be reviewed on a five-year cycle along with the official plan. Now, in terms of implementation of the guidelines, as opposed to passing a zoning bylaw to bring the guidelines into force and effect, we believe that the appropriate or recommendation would be that they be adopted by council and that the principal areas or key points of them are actually included inside the official plan and the next iteration of the official plan, and the existence and context of these guidelines is referenced in the official plan, and I think that would be the most effective way to be able to implement them. Changes to the Planning Act through Bill 73 will make this much more reasonable, much more possible, because a number of issues that have to do with placemaking, for instance, and quality environments are now provincial interests. So I think this is the appropriate way to do it as opposed through a zoning bylaw.
Thank you very much. I do have some questions. So, Councillor Downey.
Thank you.
Thank you, through you, Chair. I appreciate the report and everywhere that it's going. Serving Ward 2, which has Southfield Village, which already has design guidelines, one of the constant things that we come up against is when the design guidelines don't align with our current bylaw structure. So actually, if you go back to page 2, and I acknowledge that the graphic that you've chosen was not necessarily chosen to illustrate this issue, but if you look at the graphic for accessibility and universal design, you have kind of a very nice streetscape, like of a downtown corridor, with signage from the shops, like the type of signage that's perpendicular to the building. So that's the type of thing that makes villages look very nice and places that you want to be. However, that particular item is actually against our bylaw. So now I have businesses in my neighborhoods that are trying to achieve the design guidelines and fit in and make this beautiful community that people want to be in and are attracted to, yet our bylaws are behind and they're not in alignment with the design guidelines. So I guess my question is to staff, and as we move forward with this process and with this report, how do we make sure that our bylaws align with the design guidelines?
Through Chair to Board of Councillor Downey, so we are actually in the process of doing our sign bylaw review. In conjunction with doing the sign and review, this is why it's actually taking a little longer. We are looking at the urban design guidelines. We're looking at the CIP. We're looking at different areas of enforcement issues and the MTO, all those issues, so that when we bring the bylaw in place, it has taken into consideration all those different elements, because the urban design guidelines are more like guidelines and the sign bylaw is more of the regulation. So we'll try to address that in the bylaw that we're bringing forward for the sign review.
Okay. Councillor Mezzapelli.
Thank you, Chair DeBoer. Thank you for the presentation. I think this is something, as a comprehensive document, once we refine it and work all the feedback that you're going to receive into the final document, will be a good thing. You indicated earlier in your presentation that this will be the one design guideline, as opposed to, you know, sifting through one a number of them. And I know that even within it, you recognize there are certain areas where there may be policies that would supersede, such as an HCD, for example. I'll be honest, the thing I found challenging is when I looked at this and I looked at the timeline, and this is basically the second last stop on this process. Before it comes back for final adoption and ratification, is the ability for council to input and offer our thoughts. And when I looked at the presentation, and I understand that this is a very consolidated, high-level, general document/presentation, but I was looking at it and I said, what should I be commenting it on? And so I went on the website and I looked up the guidelines, and it's actually a very lengthy document. It's 202 pages long, which I encourage all of council to read, because that is where the nuts and bolts of what you're proposing lies. So I didn't have tons of time to I did read it, but to pour through it and really vet it out, because I think this is an extremely important document. I really do. But some things that popped up to me, I just wanted to offer to you for your consideration. Actually, it was just at the last council meeting, I had asked about, particularly in new development, which is increasingly in tight spaces, tight boulevards, small lots, as Councillor Downey was alluding to. I see in my community and my growing community examples of where things are getting extremely tight, and I'll give you an example: public boulevards, where you're going to have your street lights, you're going to have your Bell, you're going to have your Rogers, you're going to have your transformers, all of these things. And one of the things I asked at the last council meeting is, I've seen examples literally in Vaughan. They're all over the place now. It's simple: a street light that incorporates Bell and Rogers within it, and it minimizes the visual clutter. It minimizes the canvas for graffiti. and it creates a cleaner look on an ever-shrinking piece of land. And so that and anti-graffiti treatment, you do mention it briefly in the report, but it's I think it's one of the considerations for developers. I think we need to actually advocate for that to do two things, create cleaner public spaces and reduce the canvas for those who are tagging our infrastructure. So for myself, that is something that I would encourage to be included in the, because I knew you have a public realm portion, and I don't know if you wanted to comment on that. That was something that popped out to me.
We have had some feedback from city staff on the issue of the poles, and we also have some experience dealing with utility companies who are at the moment moving away. There's a particular name for that pole style, and I honestly, it escapes me right now. It'd be great to be able to remember what it was specifically to put a name on it, but they are opting out because of changes in technology. So, or at least that's the reason we've had in the past from utility companies. So they aren't necessarily, all the cable utilities aren't necessarily on board with those poles at the moment. I think that there was more interest in it when they first appeared. This is something, though, to talk to the local utilities about, because although these companies are all parts of much larger companies, they seem to operate very much on a local basis in terms of coordination of placement and stuff. So it is a broader question, actually, than one that we could answer definitively. So we weren't really in a position to mandate it specifically.
Right.
But this is something that the town staff will have to have to look at.
Yeah, and I'll say just from my observation, I'm certainly not challenging. You probably know well more than I do on this. In developing communities, I've seen it in Newmarket, in Vaughan, just as two examples, but this is going into new developments. And I just happened to speak to a technician from Rogers and asked, you know, is that a problem, sharing that little space? And now this is just a technician, but they seemed to say that there was no issue with it. So I recognize that things aren't necessarily as easy as they appear. All I'm suggesting is that we should promote solutions to what we know the future will hold. So I'll leave that with you. I just wanted to put that on the public record. And for other things that shouldn't matter as far as evolving technologies or coordination between utilities is the anti-graffiti treatment. I know that the hydro boxes have those wraps. They are aesthetically pleasing, and they also deter tagging. Canada Post has it in their mailboxes. So there's a number that do, and I think as a municipality that takes pride in how our communities look, we need to make sure that that is what we're requiring when development occurs. I will be as brief as I can.
That's a good point.
Wondered with provincial policy speaking to higher densities and the likelihood of higher order buildings, multi-story buildings, one thing that I've always thought is incorporating green spaces as a part of the development like rooftop terraces to develop issues to manage stormwater, but also create livable spaces, actually within the building itself. Is that something that you've had experience with and have a position one way or another?
We do propose a number just to test at the moment for a certain number of units proposed to include a play space or some kind of green space that the residents can use. This number will have to be tested over the next 5 years to see if it's appropriate to Caledon. It is a precedent set elsewhere in the GTA. I think Caledon needs to develop its own benchmark for when a green space is required and for what type of development. So it is something that we've spoken to staff about,
okay.
And they are it is something they're taking into consideration moving forward.
And I'm glad for that. Thank you. This is just one thing that I've noticed, and I looked through some of your more on the dense side housing stock, like your townhomes, your stacked townhomes, things like that. And nothing is operating on its own. There's always a number of factors at play at the same time. So in your document, and I'm glad to see it, you talk a lot about accessibility. Affordability is another issue that we're challenged with. And there are unique designs, even in a housing stock like townhouses, which are traditionally stair-oriented, very, you know, vertical, that I just happened across in one was in Niagara on the Lake. And they're actually accessible designs, and yet in a townhouse design, which speaks to more affordability, but also addresses accessibility. And that may be outside of the scope of this particular exercise, but I did see drawings of townhouses, and again, they're very vertical. And I think we need to be creative in this Made in Caledon kind of solution to look at housing stock in non-traditional ways to solve some of our growth in housing-related issues. So I just offer that. I think the one thing I noticed, and it was in the I made the same comment in the Bolton Heritage Conservation District guidelines, is in that section you spoke to where there is an infill redevelopment, that it be different from the historical look of the district. I'm just curious why. I was curious then, I'm curious now. If a developer wished to build something that looked historical, why that would be something that is not supported?
Well, we had the opportunity to talk to the consultants that were preparing the Bolton Heritage Conservation District study. And this is a year and a half, 2 years ago, 2 years ago. And one of the things that we could all agree on at the time was that the important thing was to maintain the character of using that as an example of an area. But one of the things that's often very crippling is very poorly done historical look style buildings. And in fact, often they have the effect of actually reducing the credibility and the quality of the real heritage buildings around them. Mm-hmm. And one of the alternatives to that, of course, is to let people build quality buildings. They may be occasionally modern buildings, but if they are contemporary and they match in terms of materials and massing, although the style may be different, as long as they represent quality and it's a limited, you know, a limited application of that, then that's a good thing, as opposed to building something which is a really poor knockoff.
Yeah. And just my opinion is I support that. Something that is newer looking yet is complementary, I don't disagree. I think that it should be supported. I would just say if we can control that it is indeed complementary, we should also be able to control that something that looks more historical would be too. And that's just how I feel on that particular issue. And I believe my last point was on page 94, there is a diagram of an infill that has existing buildings on their properties, and there's a vacant lot. And what is suggested is that wherever that street line is, that be replicated. And I understand the reason for that, because it creates a contiguous face. And I'm thinking specifically of the older commercial mm-hmm. Bolton area, where all the commercial buildings are pushed back and the parking lot is in front. And your document, rightfully so, speaks to putting the building at the front and the parking at the back. But if we have a policy that doesn't allow the first horse out of the gate, how are we ever going to get there unless it's a mass development? So I just saw that as a challenge to encouraging the first to provide the kind of orientation you're suggesting, mm-hmm. which I agree with. So I don't know if you're able to comment on that.
Well, I think this in a similar way, it goes to the issue that you talked about before about heritage, about infills and heritage. I think this is, in one way, where your architectural design review process comes in, which is to be able to look at exceptional cases and have a professional opinion on those cases as exceptions. And also what Lena mentioned about the structure of the guidelines. So it is possible that in a design requirement that you can offer an alternative, but you have to be able to justify that alternative and provide proper professional opinion about why it's okay to do something that's slightly different.
Right.
So there is flexibility built into that sense. Attempting to match the existing context is a kind of basic principle of best practice now.
Yeah. Okay. I appreciate the comment. That was it for myself. But lastly, to close, between here and when this comes back for final council approval, how can council, and you know, in consultation with our residents or what have you, continue to engage with this process, as opposed to at the very last minute?
So you can contact either one of us or Paula. Paula typically gathers all the comments
okay.
and sends them to us. So if you contact her with any comments that you have, the commenting period is open for 2 months. So take your time with the document.
Yeah.
Read through the 200 pages, maybe 100 pages a month.
Yeah.
And then, if you want to give Paula your comments, she'll forward them over, and we'll definitely take them into consideration before the document comes back in the fall.
I think it's a good idea, if possible, to read it all, because then you have the context to put each of the different bits in it. But I don't think we would ever anticipate that in using the document, anybody in the future would have to read it all necessarily. Because they're bits that speak, you know, to specific circumstances mm-hmm. or conditions. So I think an end user at the end of the day would rarely have to read it all.
Right.
If it was a very large and complicated application, then they might have to read much more of it, but not all of it is applicable to all circumstances. So I think it would be safe for people to read the parts that concern them the most and comment on those parts, as long as council actually makes an effort to read it in its entirety, so council has an opportunity to see the context for each of the bits and the comments that they will receive.
Yeah.
It should also ask that it's okay to send us comments directly, but anything that's sent to us has to be copied to Paula.
Sure.
So town staff have to have a record of everything that we receive.
Sure, fair point. Thank you very much again for your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'm going to tell you, put a lot of work into this, and I've heard public input when I've attended your meetings, when you've reached out. And I see you've identified, you've definitely listened, and I thank you for that. But to follow up with Councillor Misipelli, you were saying about urban design, and, you know, we want something that's Caledon unique, and you're right, we don't want to kill the modern creativity either, and I'll use a prime example is if you go to your slide deck where you have Spirit Tree and Heatherly, you know, that was thinking out of the box on both of those buildings, especially the Straw building. Leave you and me the amount of hurdles. No, it's the where I'm talking about is your rural Caledon, right there.
Right there, yes.
You know, the Straw building is Spirit Tree. Yeah. It was a tough one to even get staff to even support that. It was insane. And the other challenge with Heatherly, and you got to have shrubs and you got to have paved parking for wheelchair accessibility. They missed the whole mark. We got to look at what fits with the community. And we talk about that, yet, and you look up front at Town Hall, I'm sorry, it's ugly. Like, I mean, our landscaping's terrible. You know, put a fence up around it, and it'll look like a penitentiary almost, the way it's designed. So, we're beating the living daylights out of everybody else on how we want to do things, and yet we can't even lead by example. And it's a challenge. And I know, thank you for not putting the picture in of their hockey arenas over there till we get Phase 3 finished, so I really appreciate that. But I guess what I'm having to say is... yes, there's some comments and a bit of sarcasm to it. I think you've done great work, and I think we're going to really need the discipline of council to drive this to make this a reality. But where I'm going from is you look at the rural Caledon scapes. You got to have something what fits with the area, not with what is in an urban design. And that's something that's been lost, and I'm not faulting staff. They can only go by with what they're given the tools to work with. What I'm trying to say is in order to get creativity like this to celebrate, and we're going to have many other uniques. We have other craft brewers that are getting ready to establish something and other cideries that are hoping to find a home here. I don't want to kill what this is here. We want to encourage it, but it's really been tough trying to get that through the design stage. And you don't really need a site plan, but you do. And it's tough. And as I said, I'm not faulting staff, but it's what staff has to work with makes it very frustrating for a rural person. And they're not have all the services, and they're paying huge costs and already paying huge side of development charges. But I think what we have to do is what I'm just saying, when you're going forward, appreciate what rural Caledon has to offer and find what fits with it, and not let's not get caught in the urbanization requirements to make these places unique, because it's been a real struggle. And I know Heather Lee is still coming up short, you know, with trees. It's going to get there, and it's going to be so gorgeous, but you kind of got to let them, they know better than what we're trying to do with our guidelines. And I think that's the challenge and the struggle we're having. And yet, as much as we're heavy-handed on that, you get back, like, you know, Robert F. Hall looks great. I'm going to tell you, the Mayor Morrison really came down hard on the OPP station, which forced it to look a little bit better than what it was originally proposed. You know, we got the library here, and I'm going to tell you, for what we built for it, it's a beautiful building for what we got for it. But you look at Town Hall, it's a challenge. If we want to lead by example, I really appreciate your input on how we can make this facility look great. Because, you know, you drive into any parts of Ontario or anywhere in North America, you drive in a town, what's one of the nicest is the old courthouse and the town hall. I think this is, if we want this as a central part, I think we need to really focus. And I know we got some designers sitting here at council, but I mean, I really think we need to do something here. And I guess what I'm just saying, all of us sitting around here, we need to lead by example. If we want to encourage creativity, we've got to show it here too. And I think that's the only thing that I have to say that I want to make sure you can implement, because I'm going to tell you, village design, different things, you've appreciated what our village, we're a community of communities, you appreciated every community for its uniqueness, and how do we keep that uniqueness? We all don't want to be Niagara on the Lakes. In some ways, it's got that great colonial look, and it needs to be celebrated, but these communities here, the Alton has its unique style, Bell Fountain has its unique style, Chilton has its unique style, and I think you found that and definitely identified that in the books downstairs. You've done a great job on that. But on the other hand, when it comes to the urban Caledon, I think we all need to get a little more creative. You know, we're pushing hard in the industrial parks, but I think even our own facilities that we own, I think we have to start to lead by example. I know we're trying to be frugal with tax dollars, but we also are the trendsetter, right? Mm-hmm. So I'd really appreciate your help. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Mayor Thompson referenced architectural people on council. I'm one of them. 30 years in the industry. So you say unique and made in Caledon. To me, those are wonderful words. I'd like to know what you actually mean by that.
Well, one of the things that the guidelines push is context sensitivity. So in terms of development or redevelopment in any of the areas, what we're asking for first is what's built is sensitive to the context and appropriate to the context. And although that seems like a kind of general and simple thing, it actually, in some cases, can be pretty powerful. So, and you can see lots of examples in this town and others where, in fact, that hasn't taken place in the past. And it's really clear. So that first desire to be context sensitive is very important. So in this case, one of the things that the design briefs, for instance, would do, that an applicant would do, would be to have to demonstrate what it is that they're proposing, how it actually is context sensitive, and how it meets those requirements of the guidelines. It's a simple thing, but it really stops a lot of things in its tracks. So I think that's an important first step. It would be very hard and, I think, dangerous for us to have gone to each one of the places and put a label on each community within this larger community and said, well, if you're over here, you're going to be doing this, this, and this, and off you're over there, you're going to be doing these other things, because it really doesn't quite work that way. And I think that would be dangerous. So the best thing to do is to say that what's there is an example for what comes next.
If I can add to that, we've also incorporated the strategic plan's vision for Caledon. So through that effort, we've recognized that vision and we've brought it up front and center into the introductory portion of the guidelines to remind everyone that's the end game, is to have that sustainable green community of communities that really does foster unique environments that are respectful and of their heritage and their settings.
Okay, so you say it would be dangerous to look at each individual community and create a look for them. You're looking more to the community itself as it sits right now and then try to incorporate that in the guidelines for the future? I just wanted...
Yeah, the looking is the important part, if I may. The danger is putting labels on things. And I think that's always a problem because, first, you may not get it right. And secondly, you may doom it to typecasting. So you may not let things follow a natural process of evolution, of design. If you label things, well, this is the colonial neighborhood, or this is the Victorian neighborhood, or this is the neighborhood where people have their houses closer together, or this is the neighborhood where people step further back, because I think there's a kind of danger to find that. I think that everything within the town has similarities to every other community, but it also has differences, and those differences are created by geography, by time of settlement, by division of land, and by the personality of the people that have built and occupied them. So it's really hard to go about and artificially label them.
Okay, so just to give you a perspective, I'm Ward 1, so I'm the far west side of Caledon. I have all the villages. I have to say, all my villages, not one of them look alike.
Right.
And they come from a historical perspective, some of them. Like if you were to walk into Bell Fountain, there really isn't any brick house in Bell Fountain. They're all very siding and board and batten and shakes and stuff, and it has a very specific look. You could add a contemporary building into there, but then you would incorporate some of those very unique architectural elements that are very historical, and it would probably fit in. But if you went and put a house from... say Woodbridge into there, it would look like a sore thumb.
Mm-hmm.
So not only for me is it the skin of the house, but it is the mass and the scale that throws a neighborhood right out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem that I have in Inglewood. Inglewood is actually started as like a railroad town that they did all the quarries, and that's where the people worked, and there were all these wonderful little small houses, and they varied greatly. But what we have now with the infill, and so now I'm thinking more from an infill perspective, is they've taken, because they're allowed to cover X number of square feet, and they put the biggest house they can imagine that lacks. Now, they may put the siding on it, and they may put something else on it, trying to pretend like it is something, but it isn't. It looks totally out of whack. So from... it's not just the architectural elements. Mm-hmm. It really is the scale and the mass of something.
And what you describe is really a zoning issue, too. So guidelines usually can't control things like lot coverage and setbacks and stuff. So I think in that case, that's really a zoning issue. I'm not trying to pass the buck on that. Trying to, be clear that the measurements, it's a zoning issue, and it's true, because massing, that comes back to the context sensitivity issue, and that may be a reason to go back and look at some other aspects of the zoning bylaw to make sure that it's actually working with that aspect of the guidelines.
So, like a lot of the little houses, they have a lot of ins and outs, but when they go to put a new house on it, they just put a big block, because they want every square... Well, so yes. The zoning...
has to fit with the architectural elements. If not, we can't accomplish what we really and truly are trying to accomplish.
Right.
Okay. The other thing I wrote down here was, and I think it was something Councillor Mazzapelli said, and he was talking about the vertical. And I think about the property across the road from here, all those houses. And I look at that and I went, wow, it would have been so simple to go up two stories and set back the third story, that it doesn't create this massive wall that everybody goes and like gives their head a shake. Now, I don't know whether that had architectural control over it or not, but so it's not even the massing, it's the vertical and being able to set it back. And I go to Europe and I see it all the time where you'll go up a couple of stories, but then it's set back with a terrace or something. So you don't feel like you're in a walled city. Is that something that you can address through some of your guidelines?
That's, in some ways, yes. Most of that, again, comes back into a zoning requirement discussion, because there are ways that you can achieve some of these things through architectural design review and design control. But in order for the design control architect to make judgments about those things, they have to have a basis for making that judgment. And usually, stepping back, guidelines that refer to step back, backing, massing, stepping back, massing, usually also is supported by a zoning bylaw that agrees with that. So, for instance, if that is an important thing on that street at the time that that was being done, a consideration in the zoning for that site would have been the effect on the street.
So we really need to make sure that those two things marry together. It sounds like it doesn't matter what you can do from an architectural perspective. If we can't get those few things in the zoning to coordinate it, then we can't accomplish what we're really trying to accomplish.
It's very hard to compel somebody to do something unless the law works with it.
Fair enough. Okay, something else you talked about. Well, there's two things here. Everybody mentions sustainability. And I find that's like one of those words that everybody says, but they don't really mean. So for me, sustainability is not just financial sustainability, but sustainability from what we're going to put someplace. So let me give you an example. The big thing I have in my village is stormwater management. And when I look at some of the unique opportunities having to do with swales and rain gardens, where we don't have to do those massive stormwater ponds, but we require that people start doing swales with rain gardens, and we have permeable pavement, and we go on like that, we can manage it much better than doing the other. And the other costs us lots of money because we have to keep them clean, right?
Yep.
So is that something that you guys are looking at when we're talking about? I'm talking about thinking to the future and what's unique on the market now. And, of course, everybody knows here that I went to Italy and did the sustainability conference. So I garnered a lot of information from that perspective and listened to a lot of people from around the world. And we haven't implemented those things. And I'm going, if we're going to be unique, if we're going to be creative, we're going to be made in Caledon, we should be saying, no, these are the things we want.
So the region is already taking some initiative on regional roads, and they are planning on introducing some LID measures within the right-of-way. We have touched on low-impact development and opportunities for permeable paving and rain gardens throughout the document. There was some concern raised by staff about access to these facilities when they're on private lots. So if you have a rain garden on a private lot, making sure that it's still functioning the same way, and so that it's it is being cleaned, the water is still infiltrating, and it's still operating the way that it should. There has been a bit of a struggle with that in Ontario. If the control measures are on a private lot, getting access to actually ensure that they're operating properly has caused some concern. So we've introduced it. I think there needs to be some discussion through the development manual and the standards to find a way that it can really be implemented and operated.
Okay. And then another thing that I learned when I was there, and it's really quite interesting, and it takes place, I think, more in England and Ireland, is a lot of the parks are not manicured parks anymore. Mm-hmm. They're naturalized parks, which cuts down on greenhouse gases, maintenance, the whole shebang. Is that something that might be implemented? Because to me, if I'm looking to think of Caledon as being unique and stuff, then we've got to stop. We got to do something different. We can't keep saying we're going to do something different. We got to do something different. And naturalized parks seems to be in England and Ireland, seems to be a movement. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen that here in Canada or not.
Yeah, there are natural playgrounds incorporating natural elements and even using old tree barks for play equipment. And there are really neat stories of that happening in Ontario. Yeah. We do, I think we mention it, but either way, in discussion with staff, because there is a parks master plan and there's a good hold on parks planning in the town, we didn't want to run into the occasion where we mention something that's inconsistent with what's being mentioned elsewhere, so reference has been made to those documents and it should be addressed in the parks master plan.
So we need to reconcile some of those documents.
Yeah, so we're not comfortable with addressing them here if a master plan for parks is something that the town is providing, just in case they're, you know, one document's updated and the other one isn't. There could be inconsistency through those occasions.
But are you, through your process, showing where the inconsistencies are, either through zoning or through parks or through, if not, we're never going to get there.
We have been noting some recommendations for staff to review the existing zoning bylaw or the parks master plan in order to be able to reconcile some of those things.
Okay, because one of the gentlemen, he was a landscape architect in Ireland, and he said they actually, in one of their major parks, they actually let all the grass grow 1 year on one side of the park and only cut the one side, and then the next year it actually flips. So people actually get to walk through a naturalized field as opposed to having the little prickly grass under their feet, and they keep rotating it back and forth. And I thought that was actually brilliant, because we spend so much time cutting our grass and trying to make everything look like the perfect parkland when that isn't real life, right? Well,
there is a real movement actually in cities in Ontario to naturalize parks. So a lot of cases it has to do with land that's floodplain land, or it has to do with land that was playing fields at one time but are now viewed as being substandard because of grading or drainage. Yeah. It's far easier to plant them and return them to a more wild condition than it is to attempt to manicure something that's a poor resource.
100%, and we attract a lot more birds, butterflies, and the ecology, it just takes off, and I think it would be absolutely fabulous. So it's just, me, I like to see something more unique. So those are all thoughts. So I'll shush now, but that's what I was thinking. Thank you very much.
Councillor Downey.
Thank you, through you, Chair. Just a comment to the comments about naturalized parks. We actually do have naturalized park systems in Southfield Village, just for the benefit of the rest of Council, through the walkways and the EPAs, basically, that connect with the TRCA land. So we do have... four naturalized areas. And so from my perspective, coming from a rural property, I also think that they look good and they kind of keep are fitting with, the rural urban cross-section that we're looking for. However, they do come with challenges when you have people moving into high-density areas that are looking for or coming from areas that are more typical to an urban setting. So the challenges are oftentimes garbage, wind blowing, the tall grasses, you end up with a lot of paper refuse, things like that. The community cleanup days are not always able to really deal with that, nor is park staff. I personally have had many phone calls about, too many crickets, too many this, too many that. people that are maybe not used to that, that rural or naturalized system. You have residents that buy homes in these neighborhoods and they're looking for golf course type conditions within their park systems, which, as Councillor Shaughnessy mentioned, isn't, that's not real life. So it's almost a retraining of our society in terms of what is real and what it takes to keep things in that golf course like state, which is obviously not natural, and to appreciate that naturalized area. I think that's basically my point, is that we really need to look to our communities and the people within them to appreciate the naturalized state and help maintain it as it is, so that we're not faced with the challenges that come with the naturalized area. And on an anecdotal note, I actually have a resident in Southfield Village that replaced their entire front lawn with turf. So you're, like, these are the things that you're trying to balance. And although when you drive down the street, it's like somewhat comical. Like, this is the society that we're working with, and you know, people don't want that maintenance and those types of things. So we do have them. We do have naturalized area. They're good, so thank you.
Okay, I just had a few comments. Very extensive report, and I'm going to read it more detail later. I do have a couple of questions, though, and your comment was administering it through the official plan as opposed to the zoning bylaw. And I've always been taught that having something through an official plan doesn't give you enough latitude to be flexible within the plan or within the package of what you're trying to accomplish. When you've got it as a zoning bylaw, you have a little bit more ability to, and a little bit easier ability to kind of make it flexible. You've got a set of guidelines to work with, but if you want to try and work within them a little bit better, it's always easier to do it through the zoning bylaw. So I'm just wondering where your comment is on that and what your thinking is with regards to the OP.
I still believe in the OP process. In part, it just means you have to pick your words a lot more carefully. So if you do it through the OP, you have the advantage of having the a kind of higher tier decision, because the zoning bylaw is there to implement the official plan. So if you put it in the official plan, then you've set in action some of the things that we were talking about that you would need to have support about from the zoning about. So you put it in the official plan, that causes a chain over time that would lead possibly to modification of zoning bylaws. So if you put it in the zoning bylaw only, then you're dealing with it as a zoning matter, and it's there for a different form of appeal. I would much rather that it went into the official plan, and you were able then to say explicitly in the official plan, these are the policies, you can go to the guidelines, and in the guidelines it says, if you can't do it in this particular way, here is the way, the route that you take administratively to do it differently. And I think that's a better process, because it has to a justification that allows you to deal with specific instances as opposed to a zoning bylaw.
Okay. 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 I'll think about that some more. One of the other ones is you talk about the design in the context of the community. And I would hope that, and this is one scenario, and I think we talked about it earlier, in the context of the community is when we start getting infill lots in the rural area and large homes, and then how do you deal with them? Like, my thinking is it's got to be in the context. So you've got your one-acre lots that are essentially along the road. Well, then developing an infill lot where it ends up being behind. And when you talk about in the context of the community, the house should be closer to the road if it stays within the context of the smaller lots. But does this give us the administrative clout, so to say, to look at saying the design of that house needs to be closer to the road, but we also don't want to have a 4,000 square foot house sitting essentially on top of the road, and then that changes the urban character of the area as well?
It begs a really, it's a good point. I think that in general we have a handle on that, but your example is a good one, so we're going to have to go back and think about that. This also connects to a comment of the mayor's, because the mayor points out that there is a difference between rural and urban, and yet these are called urban design guidelines. Well, urban design is called urban design because it was about urban places, and I haven't yet come across anybody who's actually written in Ontario what you would call rural design guidelines. And there's lots of sort of bits and pieces, but nobody has actually really done that. And I think it's just because it's been overlooked.
Well, I think it has been. I think we're probably in a unique position here in that being on the urban fringe in the GTA, a lot of these infill lots that historically were, you know, 10 acres, 20 acres are being picked up now, especially with the price of real estate in Toronto, is making these pieces of land very attractive because you've got room and you're probably not spending a whole lot more than an apartment, than the price of an apartment in downtown Toronto. The commuting is there. So it's how do we recognize, come up with a set of guidelines that recognizing the current and long serving or the residents that have been there for a long time. In some cases, it might be just the property that's been there for a long time, but they buy in with a certain expectation of rural life. And yes, you can say, well, if you want to maintain that view, buy it. Well, that isn't necessarily realistic, but there's also a certain expectation of keeping it. And I don't want to get down the road of where the NEC was and when they started and down that road all those many years ago with regards to protecting the view, but I think there's some things that we can do more because we haven't done anything. So we can certainly start looking at it, and it'll be maybe an interesting piece that we certainly need to look at. And the impacts are happening more and more. I know of two in my ward, and I think they're going to end up being more prevalent as time rolls on, because it is a we have a desirable location. I think everything else you do, like when you talk about low impact development, that's great. We've been talking about it for a long time. It's a matter of getting TRCA involved, getting the engineers involved, and looking at how do we develop under the current densities. And that's going to be the next thing. How do we do low impact development when we've got such high densities and the requirement for paved roads? But I know that in conversations with staff, we're looking at an addition to the parking lot here, and I think that's the direction that they are going, I believe, is lower impact and trying to deal with minimizing the impact. So we're at a position where we can start doing it ourselves too. So it is the lead by example. But I would hope that in the rural area, we don't end up making and the mayor did come up with the example, but making the people that want to develop an on-farm business and making this another step in between, because a lot of on-farm businesses come with a number of hoops to have to go through just to be able to develop the business. And the reality is there isn't a lot of extra money in it. And then each $5,000 fee and every $10,000 you pay to a consultant, it takes you years to get that back. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, there isn't a lot of money in it, and that's where you got to kind of take a step back to how do we get to where we want to get to without introducing a lot of costs and a lot of hurdles. So I generally really like the work that you've done, and look forward to having a really close look at it and work with our staff to make sure that we've get to a good conclusion. And I have no further questions for you, and neither does anybody else. So I want to thank you for your presentation.
Thank you very much.
Okay, the next item on the agenda is correspondence. And if there was any correspondence that needs to be addressed, I'm just trying to find mine. Councillor Mezzapelli?
Yes, thank you, Chair DeBoer. This is with respect to the memorandum regarding the White Belt Visioning Exercise, which we'll be having the third open house on April 20th. I took the time to go through the different open houses and the different goals of the open houses, and the one previous to the one we're going to be having on the 20th was held on June 27th. Of last year, and what it basically put together was different, very high level of options of what different land uses could occur within the White Belt for various different uses, residential, employment, agriculture, rural areas, that type of thing. The very end of the memorandum, which I understand to be the goal or the outcome, the expectation of this open house, is strictly looking at different employment options and strategies within the White Belt. I know that employment is the only use that we can protect for, according to provincial policy, but as this is a visioning exercise, I'm just wondering why it's exclusively on the employment side.
I apologize. I'm just trying to find the memo here. So.
Sorry. Through you, Chair of the Board, Councilman Zappelli. So this open house will be looking strictly at employment. However, there will be a follow-up one that looks at other land uses in September. We're aiming for September for the second part.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any further? Mayor Thompson?
The only way we can do any visioning exercise is we can do it for employment lands. It's in the provincial policy statement. They've allowed that in provincial policy statement 2014. That way we can keep our greenbelt sustainable financially to make sure we protect enough employment land. That's why they've allowed us to be able to vision that way. We can't do residential. Agriculture already exists, but we got to be careful where we go in between. We can't look at residential planning whatsoever in this visioning exercise. We just can't do that because the provincial policy statement won't allow us to do it.
Councillor Mazzapelli.
Thank you, Chair DeBoer. And I'm not trying to debate with Mayor Thompson, but my understanding of the visioning exercise is I understand that we can only by provincial policy protect for employment. I understand and agree with you on that. But the visioning exercise is, although we can't protect it, it is a vision for our white belt. And looking at all uses, including agriculture. And so that was the only reason I made the point. And I appreciate the fact that there will be subsequent. Yep, no point well taken. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, the next item on the agenda is the confidential session. And the following motion is required to go into confidential session. That the Planning and Development... Planning Development Committee, shall go into confidential session under Section 239 of Municipal Act for the following purpose. Confidential staff report 2017-7 regarding advice that is subject to solicitor client privilege and litigation, including matters before an administrative tribunal affecting the municipality. Mayfield West Phase 2 OMB appeals and moved by Councillor Mazzapelli, seconded by Councillor Downey. This was held. Councillor Mazzapelli. So we will. Yeah, all in favor? Okay. Okay. So confidential staff report 2017-7 regarding advice that is subject to solicitor client privilege and litigation, including matters before an administrative tribunal affecting the municipality Mayfair West Phase 2 OMB appeals. The confidential staff report 2017-7 regarding the advice that is subject to solicitor client privilege and litigation, including matters before an administrative tribunal affecting the municipality Mayfair West Phase 2 OMB appeals be received. The mayor and clerk be authorized to execute minutes of settlement between A Major Homes Ontario Inc. and the Corporation Town of Caledon as attached to Schedule A to staff report 2017-7, and the mayor and clerk be authorized to execute minutes of settlement between the Orangeville Railway Development Corporation ORDC and the Corporation of the Town of Caledon as attached to Schedule B of the staff report 2017-7, subject to the ORDC board approval. Legal counsel be authorized to make minor modifications to the minutes of the settlement and policy modifications to the satisfaction of the town solicitor. That staff be directed to attend the OMB, Ontario Municipal Board OMB hearing May 17th, 17 in support of the minutes of settlement, and that staff be directed to report back to council with further amendments to the community design plan and the transportation master plan once modifications to OPA 222 have been approved by Ontario Municipal Board. And it was moved by a mover, Councillor Mazzapelli, seconded by Councillor Innes. All in favor? Carried. And this should conclude the evening. Thank you very much.